time to start talking about games.
Yeah, right. All right. Today is September 29th, 2011. This is the second interview with Tim Frandy. Again, we're here at Memorial Library. And again, I am Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. And we're interviewing Tim about the project we're calling Capitol Protests 2011, the protests on the in and around the Capitol in February and March of 2011. So, Tim, when we left off, we were talking about the February 11th, sort of that weekend building up to the first event. And so the question I'd like to ask to get us going is, from what I remember you saying, the February 14th event was going to happen anyway. But then the Governor Walker's email came out. Did that change? Obviously, I mean, it changed a lot of things, but did it change the basic idea of that February 14th event?
Yeah, it wasn't a hard tweak. I think that what we had planned was this I Heart UW rally, because everybody knew that, you know, big budget cuts were coming, you know, over 10%. And, you know, I know it varies place by place in, you know, in the university, but there's like a lot of grad students who have like photocopy limits, you know. Mm-hmm. They're allowed to make one photocopy per student per week, you know, one page, and then everything else comes at their own expense. And so, you know, I mean, we're totally, like in the humanities, we're totally resource deprived. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Over in the med school, you know, they have pharmaceutical companies bringing in free lunch for them every day, but mm-hmm. you know, we don't have coffee, you know. And so anyway, anyway, you know, we don't want budget cuts, of course, mm-hmm. and we're pretty strapped already. So this Valentine's Day thing, it was planned as a, you know, don't cut UW funding. You can even find the image online if you Google I Heart UW. It was a two-sided like half sheet handout. And the idea was that it was Valentine's and a bunch of TAA and undergrad folk, and I believe lots of professors signed these Valentines too. We're going to deliver them to the governor's office. And then on the 11th, when, you know, we'd already organized and sort of planned this, we sort of tweaked it a little bit to be a, it was still mostly a, you know, a rally and not a protest, though of course the tone was shifting pretty dramatically, mm-hmm. when people realized how serious this was. So, and there was Peter Rickman did a lot of the speaking during that, and you can find media clips of him from the 14th that were posted. He gave a great sort of stump speech about how, you know, kind of poking fun at how Governor Walker's going to be a heartbreaker on Valentine's Day, you know. And but you know, he had this great soundbite. He said, "Well, this is not a protest. It's a rally to show our love for higher ed in the state." And you know, we didn't want to deviate from message because we didn't know at first. I mean, we had no way of telling what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I think most of us at that point anticipated, I mean, this is what I anticipated, that we'd have our rally, and I think we turned out about 1,500, which is the biggest rally anybody'd seen in the Capitol for a while, I think. Well, there was a big anti-Walker thing in January, but I missed that. Anyway, it was a pretty good rally for us. And I mean, you know, we had envisioned the Wisconsin AFL-CIO was planning 2 days of rallies. And, you know, I sort of figured, well, maybe if we're lucky we got like 5,000-8,000 people to show up, and then they go home, and then we do it two or three times, and then what? You know, because that's the nature of a rally. Show up, there's some speeches, people cheer, and then they go home, and nothing really changes. But, you know, it turned out to be much different, you know, mm-hmm. obviously, mm-hmm. than that.
So, after the 2:14 event, and then of course all this came about the same weekend as the, or a few days before, with the email and the basic shell of what the budget repair bill was like. When did the TA, or what was in the mindset of the TA about what was going to be? I mean, you said sort of what your initial thoughts were, but what did the TAA start to do after February 14th? To, I guess, sort of change, you know, you talk about this is not a protest, this is a rally. Mm-hmm. It becomes a protest pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
So how does that change, from your memory and your experience in it, how does the TAA start to change tact or tactics?
I think it became a protest as soon as it's kind of just semantic splitting hairs, you know. But, you know, we're always vigilant of the message, the public message. You know, there were people working the crowds to make issue. As soon as, like, the Walker equals Hitler signs started coming out, we had people working the crowds and saying, we don't need that sort of sign. You're hurting us more than helping us, because the media's picking up on this and making us look like a bunch of idiots. So, I mean, there's always this message control that's kind of done informally, you know. And you can't convince everyone, you know. I mean, I guess we kind of knew it was going to go to a protest at some point, but I think the telling moment for me, anyway, was when I started seeing initial poll numbers come in and saying that, you know, 60-65% of Wisconsinites think that public employees should have the right to have unions, you know, and only like 30% supported Walker's legislation, then you know that the public's got your back and you're doing things right, and then you can get a little bit more aggressive in your tact and messaging, and tactics and messaging, I think. I think you're asking me something else, and I'm answering a different question.
Well, let's sort of talk logistics then, because at some point, the TAA takes up residence inside the Capitol.
Yeah, that happened.
So why don't we talk about either your direct involvement or indirect involvement in that, and maybe go from there.
Okay. Well, so for the 15th, so we had this rally on the 14th, and, you know, we're happy with it, and we're tickled pink that the Badger Herald picked it up and even made the Isthmus, the Daily Page website, and we're kind of giddy about that. And then we went back to the office, and we worked long into the night, and I was organizing that night. I don't remember exactly what I was doing. I was, I think what I was doing, I was calling people. I had done this database work because for 2 years, like, we didn't have the best membership secretaries who took care of our records of our members. So a lot of cards had not been entered. Like some, maybe up to like 800 cards, membership cards, with, you know, addresses and phone numbers and emails and names and all these things. They weren't properly maintained. So me and one of my friends, Jason Schroeder, basically sat down and we entered all of them by hand into a spreadsheet, which took like 2 days, like 20 hours or something of work, you know, times two. Quite a time-consuming process. And then we're making these call lists, and then we'd get these pages done, and then people would start making calls and, alerting our members that, you know, something terrible is happening. And a lot of people didn't know, you know. I think that's what I was doing on the 14th. I remember the office was filled with people that were making signs. They'd been making signs for days. First it was Valentine's Day signs, and I remember some undergrads were making the Slack Kids, a student labor action coalition, mostly undergrad activist types, and they they're using our office and making spray painted banners of like the Imperial Walker images and things like that. So the next day we knew that there was going to be this public testimony. The Joint Finance Committee is required to hold public testimony on any bill that they consider. And according to customary practice, what they've always done is they listen to public testimony on any bill until there's no more to be heard. And we knew that there were going to be busloads of maybe up to 10,000 people or whatnot coming for these rallies. And we thought, well, people are coming in from all over the state. People have families, you know, what we can do strategically being TA is we're going to wait until we're going to get a big bunch of people to show up late. Because at 9 o'clock, the rallies will be done. People will be going home. And then a whole bunch of TA folks will show up, dragging everyone we can to do these public testimonies. And so I think from this, because then from this thing that we thought, well, we're going to make them stay there as late as we can, all night if we can, you know. And so then I love this. My Alex Hanna, who's the current co-president of the TAA, he created a Facebook group called Sleep With Your TA and invited all these undergrads to, sleep with the TA, and invited undergrads and said, we're going to come to the Capitol late, bring your sleeping bags, bring your pillows. It's going to be an all-night thing. And, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen. You know, we were getting ready for the chance that we might try to occupy it. And we thought if we have the numbers and we need to, we're going to be ready to occupy it and or get arrested. So, so people were testifying all day, and I don't even remember what I was doing. I was working in the office, in the TAA office, probably doing more of this data stuff and phone call stuff. And then around 9 o'clock, I think, maybe it was about 8:45, we got a call from inside the Capitol to the office, and it said, everybody's got to get here now. They're going to lock the doors at 9, or they're going to stop hearing people testify at 9, so everyone has to get on the list. And then, you know, they're going to lock the Capitol doors, and we couldn't get in. They're going to try to cut it off. So, I don't know, we had a dozen people or so, maybe 20 people in the office, and we quick locked up, and everyone, I mean, we literally sprinted to the Capitol up State Street and to get in line so we could get in the Capitol, get in line and testify, and try to keep this thing going all night. And we packed the line, which had been pretty steady and constant the whole day. And the line just, you know, all of a sudden there were 100 or more people waiting in line. And they started going on. People would fill up these little cards, and you could only testify once, and you had like 3 minutes to talk. It turned out I was the last person to fill one out before they cut it off. I got to the front of the line, I filled out mine, and they said, somebody came out from the office where they were doing the hearings, they said, that's it, no more. And then, fortunately for me, I'm not much of a yeller, but fortunately for me, there were the crowd of people who were able to, you know, push up to the front and get irate about it and such, and I remember I was very relieved that I didn't have to make too big of a scene, because I don't like doing that too much. Like Adrienne Padgett, who's a co-president, I remember she came up and got right in somebody's face, and so I was happy about that. So then then we're in the hallway, and then people started flooding into this tiny little hallway because the word got out to the rotunda what had just happened, and people from the rotunda started flooding in, and we jammed this hallway, and people started yelling, you know, kill the bill, or, you know, let us in, stuff like that. And we yelled louder and louder, and they had in the rotunda this giant television. And I was only in the hallway, but apparently there was this giant television in the rotunda so people could watch the hearings. And somebody came running in from the rotunda. We were yelling, and somebody came in and waved their arms and got our attention, and they said, they started yelling, "It's working. They can hear you. Chant louder." And so everyone got louder, and this went on for like 45 minutes. But we disrupted them so much that, I mean, they couldn't function. It was just driving them crazy. Because the Republicans just wanted to go home, and then the Democrats wanted to draw it out as long as they could. And so Representative Taylor, she's from southern Milwaukee area, I think.
Okay.
Lena Taylor.
Okay.
She came out and asked us to please be quiet for a while because she was trying to negotiate with Republicans. And she was trying to, you know, broker a deal to keep the testimony going. And they agreed to testify and to take testimony until 2 in the morning. And then the Republicans said that they'd only do that, and then they were going to walk and try to cram the bill through. I mean, the whole plan is to get the bill through by Thursday anyway, you know. It got to 2, and they walked, and they didn't even come close to getting my name. And then there was a press conference that the Democrats had at that time in the rotunda, and the basic understanding was that their position was that, you know, the Republicans walked, and now the Democrats will continue to take, you know, the people's testimony, you know, all, as long as it takes. And so, but the crowds needed that because we needed the political cover, because there's a law that says as long as there's a meeting going on, the public is welcome in the Capitol. I don't know if it's a law, it's some sort of, you know, policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, we're continuing to meet, you know. Even though it wasn't the official meeting, they kept taking testimony, which gave, you know, people in the rotunda the cover to stick around. So
mm-hmm.
that's how the occupation started. Then that first night, then they took a little break. They started taking more testimony. And the first night, everyone is exhausted, and somehow everyone just went to sleep. And I got stuck with, I was the only one up, and they needed more people to testify. So it was like me and one other person. And my job that first night was to wake people up and tell them to go testify, which was one of the most horribly painful things I've ever had to do, you know? Everyone was exhausted. You'd shake them and say, "I'm so sorry. We need people to testify right now. Go, go." And so I did that from like 3 until about 6:30 in the morning. Woke people up. And then people started waking up on their own. That first night I was up for like 40 hours or something without any sleep. I was up the whole first night, I didn't even lie down. And then I was up all the next day, and I didn't go to bed until like midnight the second day. And I slept pretty good on the marble floor then.
So I have a timeline here. This all sort of conflates in my mind. When When did the 14
leave? I think it was that Thursday.
Okay.
Because the first day there was a JFC meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Or the first day it was the testimony. Then the second day was the JFC vote, probably.
Okay.
And then it was the assembly vote on that Thursday. And okay. Then the senators probably left then. And that Thursday was a huge day. There was some. That was the day that I felt like we actually had some real momentum for the first time.
Okay. What are your memories, sleep-addled memories of the Thursday then, where you feel like momentum actually starts?
Well, you know, the thing that sticks out there are a few things it was the 14 leaving that was the big thing. I mean, I suppose it could have been Wednesday, but my memory says it was Thursday.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, there were a couple things. I'd have to look at my photos. I think the what happened is this. This is why Thursday felt so important to me, because the 14 left, and I don't have a lot to say about that. You know, the rumors swirled around that the 14 had left. Then I saw a few news reports. I mean, lots of the time that first week I was doing media control stuff because, I don't need to make it sound more important than it was, but all the mainstream media was starting to pick us up. I mean, by like that Thursday, Friday, I don't know when it came out. Kevin Gibbons, who was the other co-president last year, he was like on the front page of the LA Times. They did a big story on us, you know, on the TAA. We're flattered. I mean, but then like on Thursday, I bet it was like that Thursday when we started to be picked up in London and out Al Jazeera. And, you know, it was like, wow, you know, suddenly this is just not, I mean, 3 days earlier, it was like, ooh, the isthmus, you know? And then like, we're in every newspaper in the country and all, so many around the world, you know? And I was, within the first 2 weeks, I mean, I did an interview, I did these quotes that were translated in Swedish for a newspaper, you know, in Norway, you know, I did an article for a paper, for a literary journal on the protest. You know, these things started like picking up, and everyone was using their talents to do, you know, to disseminate information worldwide. But the problem is that, like, you know, the national media has paid no attention to Wisconsin politics, state politics, you'd read NBC News or whatever, CNN, and it would say things like, well, the unions don't really want to have their benefits cut, and then Scott Walker says there's a financial crisis. And, you know, we'd already done our homework. We knew that, you know, the state was it, you know, yes, the state had a slight debt problem, but it, compared to the other states, we were right in the middle of the pack. We were like the 23rd best state for financial situation. You know, we're totally average. We didn't have a real type crisis. It was trumped up. Then, we tried to message on that. We tried to find these facts. He said, well, public employees get these gold-plated insurance and pension plans. Like, well, okay, so we had people researching that. We drag up this information that, you know, trace the statistics to, the only people ever done stats on this were, you know, funded by unions, as far as I know. But, I mean, there are studies which I trust, I guess, said that public employee, and, you know, they get about like 8% less when you compensate for education, you know, than private sector employees. So, you know, we're trying to get all this sort of information out, you know, and it was an ongoing thing. So, you know, I was emailing journalists and trying to like articulate our side, and I was, you know, trying to find good stories and spread them on Facebook and that sort of thing. I think the other thing that happened on Thursday was the day that we tried to block doors. And probably that Wednesday we had a TAA meeting inside the Capitol, and I don't even remember who they are, some national folks from AFL-CIO. I mean, geez, like Randy Weingarten showed up to our meetings, and Richard Trumka, and Randy Weingart's the president of AFT National. Richard Trumka is head of the AFL-CIO. He's a great speaker. I like Richard Trumka a lot. But they showed up at our meetings, you know, which was kind of surreal, you know. And, you know, tried to rally us up and whatnot. They're getting us ready for to... They wanted us to go and get arrested and such, I think. But it's hard to... It made for a really kind of awkward, intense dynamic, too. You know, when people are, you don't know, are coming in and saying, okay, go get arrested, you know. And, you know, for us, you know, our average income for grad employees is right at the poverty line, you know, $12,000, $13,000 a year. And, you know, it's that $300, $400 is a lot of money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's half a month of income.
Mm-hmm.
So, So I blocked some doors that day too. I blocked one in particular. I was doing a lot of the media organizing stuff. I was sitting in the hallway near a plug-in, near the TA war room. And, you know, periodically, we had launched this Defend Wisconsin site, and they were using Twitter feeds to mobilize people and get them in front of certain doors. So, you know, block, you know, whatever, 330 South right now, you know, and then a flood of people would go and block that door. I mean, the idea is that so if you block the doors, then they can't, the politicians can't get into the room and meet to hold a vote. So that's why we're blocking doors. One of my favorite stories that happened to me was that I, you know, there was a real shortage of people in front of one door. So it was on Twitter, and then people said, yeah, it's real, we need people there now. So, you know, I dropped my stuff and just went to the door. And this was another thing. I mean, the crowd in there, yeah, I have left my backpack with my laptop in it unattended so many times, and it was so dumb. And my whole dissertation, it wasn't even backed up. And my whole dissertation, my whole academic career of writing on my computer, and the number of times I just left it sitting out, you know, and I'd be on the other side of the building. I mean, it's amazing what, I mean, it says a lot about the crowd, you know. It's and remarkable, really. But, you know, it's what you had to do, too. I mean, if I'm blocking a door and, you know, things could get ugly, then I don't want to have it smashed either.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so I went over and I blocked the door, and there was some scare tactics. People were circulating little notes around that said, you know, if you know what to do if you're arrested and how you're going to be charged with a crime, and I don't even know who was circulating these things. We think that there were conservative groups just to spook people, you know, about the fact that they might get arrested, but I could be wrong. So I was sitting in front of, I got in front of this door, and there was someone who, I don't remember. I don't think I knew who the person was, but I mean, they were doing the body mobilization stuff, you know, gave very specific instructions on what to do, you know, how we'd sit together, and then if somebody came up, you know, we're supposed to get closer together and lock arms, and, you know, told us how to position our body and make sure that nobody got through. And he said, well, where we are now, we're blocking like half of a hallway. So what we think is going to happen is somebody's going to come up this elevator, and so you have to block the elevator. And he said, we've got people on the floors below us, and they're just sitting in the open elevator doors, and they're not moving. So the doors should not be going anywhere. But if for some reason these people do move, we're pretty sure that they're going to come up the elevator, because that's the one way that they'll have easiest access to get into this room that you're protecting. And I sat there, you know. It you know, this is 3-4 days in. I hadn't left the Capitol. Maybe I left the Capitol to get coffee a couple times, but I really didn't leave that first week. Once I went home to shower, people didn't smell so good, you know, and your teeth just felt fuzzy and awful, and so I was sitting next to the door and sitting really close to all these other people and uncomfortable and tired and sweaty and everyone's smelling bad, and we sit there for like an hour, nothing's happening, and, you know, just doing whatever, you know, it is that we do, passing the time, I guess. And suddenly somebody looks up and they notice that the elevator has changed a floor. It was on basement, now it's on one. And it's a really slow moving elevator. So everyone like gasped and crowds in together and locks arms and gets ready, and it goes to two. We're on three. We're still waiting. This whole thing felt like it took 5 minutes, you know? And I looked over to the people who are blocking the door, and it's like a bunch of like 100-pound 18-year-old girls. And I was pretty close to them too. I thought, oh shit. These girls are not going to be able to like outmuscle police officers. Like, you know, I thought, what am I gonna do? I'm gonna have to kind of jump in there and I don't know, you know? I thought it was gonna be ugly. Three. Door opens very slowly. And there's no police officers, but instead there's a woman in a wheelchair holding a sign that says Walker equals Hitler. So, yeah, not exactly what we expected.
Oh, that is a great story, though.
We took her out. She got out of the elevator. We put her right in front of the door to make sure that, you know, if any cops do come through, then they'd have to push over a woman in a wheelchair to get to the room.
You mentioned a couple different times Facebook, and one of the specific questions we have is the idea of really, how did Facebook and other social media influence the protests? I wonder if you want to elaborate a little bit more on protests these days, whether it's here or in other parts of the world. The word gets out quickly because of that.
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. It's it's the new reality, I guess, of social unrest. Which, I mean, it's a fantastic tool. I mean, we need people to block the doors, and somebody sends a tweet that says, I don't even use Twitter, you know, but I got on it just so I can follow these things. But, you know, block this door, and you know, people know right away. The downside is that it can become quite a rumor mill, and I think there was a lot of intentional deception that used to spread bad information. I mean, the rumors that were flying on the floor was crazy, you know. Everyone was going to be arrested every single day, and the craziest one I heard was that the Teamsters were coming to push around public union employees, and that didn't really make any sense. The Teamsters did show up, but they, you know, super supportive. I don't know. They have a reputation for violence, you know, and, mm-hmm. but yeah, there were some strange things that went around. The thing that I thought was important, I mean, the Twitter was important for mobilizing people on Facebook, but it was the ability to, you might say it sort of democratizes like the media process a little bit. Because the media coverage was so bad, and so much bad information. I mean, the national media got the story wrong time after time after time. And then you have this Wisconsin State Journal and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, both of which are very conservative papers. And they were blatantly misrepresenting things. I mean, on purpose too, I think. I vowed never to buy either paper again during that time because I thought their coverage was so atrocious. Both endorsed Walker, and both were convinced, you know. And they've sort of mellowed, I think, since they realized that how wildly unpopular this was, but they were no friends of you know, protesters, especially early on. So, you know, I mean, the one thing I saw, you know, PolitiFact, right? It's run out of Florida, but so, you know, there was a time in the protest. This was further on, but like, you know, tell the story to talk about a little bit about media, you know, and how it represents things that go on. You know, one of the issues that we're having is that, well, after they locked down the Capitol about 3 weeks in, two weeks in maybe they locked down the Capitol. It's really hard to get in and out. So, you know, we started opening bathroom windows and such and sneaking pizzas in, and people would go, you know, climb through the bathroom windows to get into the Capitol. That's a pretty normal occurrence. And so what the Department of Administration did is they started putting bolts in the windows to make sure that they didn't open. Literally. There are photos of bolts, them installing bolts in the window so they can't open. And then, you know, some Democrats complained to the media that they're bolting the window shut, which literally they were doing. And PolitiFact evaluated the statement that they're bolting the windows shut, and they declared it pants on fire lying. Even though they were literally bolting the windows shut. They said, well, just because they're bolting the windows shut doesn't mean that they're actually bolting the windows shut. Don't you, if you had a state capitol building, wouldn't you keep your windows locked too? But like, no, literally, there were, I mean, you know, it was a very, I see what they're saying, that maybe it's a normal security measure, but to declare a pants on fire lie, the worst type of lie, that they're what they're doing is literally bolting the window shut. I mean, it was just, you know, it's intolerable coverage. So anyway, so I mean, I think that, you know, trying to get the message, you know, right in state, trying to spread it out of state, trying to get the filter this message to the media, because we knew at whatever point we realized that this is going to be one in, you know, public opinion, court of public opinion, and not through a legal process. You know, we weren't going to sway anyone. That was a realization that occurred at some point. So.
So I was trying to look here on the timeline and see what mm-hmm. what day it was that they might have been. Well, it says Wisconsin authorities back away on Sunday, February 27th, from a threat to evict hundreds of labor rights demonstrators.
Yes, that was a Sunday. I wasn't there on that day. I tried to get in, but I was the doors were locked. Or the lines were too long to get in. They started putting up the... Mm. And if it was, they probably had security screenings going on at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it difficult to get in for me.
I remember, again, not to get too much of me on here, but I gave a presentation for the academic staff yearly conference. They mm-hmm. don't call it that, but it's... And that way it was at the hotel just down off the square.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went in, and that was Friday the 25th. And at that point, it was still, they were funneling people into specific doors, but there wasn't metal detectors yet. So I think it was that weekend where the sort of the, if you want to call it a crackdown,
yeah. Yeah.
crackdown started.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, a couple of things I want to ask, and this again, you know, might get to specific anecdotes, mm-hmm. it might just get to general opinions,
mm-hmm.
is. You talk about, and you mentioned this when we met without the recorder, that you took photos
mm-hmm.
of this, and this is a very well, in a sense, it's a very well-documented protest, because,
mm-hmm.
again, the times that we live in, you know, as you mentioned before, you have a field recording kit
right
in your phone.
Exactly.
Or flip, you know, the flip video or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
My specific question, though, is did you come a time where you sort of realized that this was not only a current political event, but also a uniquely historical event? And even though you're not a historian per se, you, I want to ask it this way. Why did you decide to take pictures?
Well, I would say that I started taking pictures maybe around the 14th, because I could tell that there was a difference, you know? I mean, yeah, I mean, I've done labor stuff in the past, and it's, you know, and I always sort of recognized what was happening was interesting and important and worth documenting, but at the same time, I didn't want the documenting of it to obstruct from my participation in it, you know. I wanted to, you know, it was more important that I was there as an activist than as an ethnographer. You know, there are moments that, you know, sort of stand out, you know, is where you realize it's important. I remember as in the working in the union office, the, you know, you see either the 13th or 14th, they would say in the photos, and I started taking some photos because I mean, it was so different. There were so many people in the office. You know, I was there, you know, all day long and such. And so, you know, I always take my shoes off when I'm in the office and want to be comfortable. So my shoes were off and I had to like tiptoe around people and step over people. And, it, you know, you could barely walk through the office because there were so many people working. And then I was like, wow, this is amazing. Look at all these people, you know, working together and doing everything they possibly can. And so I took some photos of that. And then when we marched on the 14th, you know, when we marched on the Capitol, we had, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 people. And, or as the media reported, dozens of people. Another reason the media was lacking. Yeah, dozens of people showed up. and so, you know, I took some video clips of when we entered the Capitol building. That wasn't, I mean, entering the Capitol for the first time was a pretty intense experience because I hadn't seen that many people in the State House, you know, inside, because you can make a lot of noise in there. When you're on State Street and you're yelling, like, the sound just goes away, but it really can fill up the rotunda. So, you know, there are various points like that, I guess. And then, you know, it was that Thursday, right? Once the Democratic senators left, I mean, you knew that was important. It was more than just a protest. It was historic at that point because at least some politicians listened, you know, and responded, you know, in this fashion. You know, and there was also a moment because, I mean, in the first night or two of the occupation, it was small. The first night, I would guess there were about 150, 200 people there, max. It was quite small. As largely TAA and undergrads. The Wednesday night, I don't remember so well because I was asleep. But by Thursday, I think lots of that first week, I was up till 3 in the morning and then up awake at 6, you know, I didn't get much rest at all. And I wasn't on the floor so much. I wasn't, you know, I did a little yelling and stuff, but I was doing more organizing, you know, away from the crowds and trying to get people to come and work with the messaging. But the third night, things started changing, you know, and that's, you know, the high school kids were marching at that point, and the high school kids would come, you know, the Madison schools were closed. I think the TAA had started the teach-outs at that point, and things were getting to be pretty intense. And so I remember, because on the floor, I was upstairs, and it was probably like midnight or 2 in the morning, and people came up, and they're like, oh, there's all these high school kids, I don't know what to do. These high school kids, they're drinking, they're smoking pot in the bathrooms, like, they're drinking openly on the floor. And like I tell him, you know, you guys have to take this someplace else. You can't do this in here. And you know, they just don't care. And so a few of us got together, and I was relieved I didn't have to do it. I said, you know, I was busy with something else. And I said, well, can you go around as a group and like, you know, like nicely ask them to like, you know, if they're gonna drink or whatever, take it outside, you know, do it someplace else, like do it in the bathroom in secret, just don't. Because I mean, we thought, you know, the national media is not our friend, state media isn't our friend, like they find out that one, you know, high school kids smoking pot in the bathroom of the Capitol, and then we're just a bunch of like, you know, radical lazy hippies who are corrupting the youth of this country. So, you know, it took on a life of its own. That was the point when I realized that this thing is no longer like controllable. And that's when the drum circle and the Capital City community really started moving in. And we started seeing like the presence of the medics and the, you know, the info desk crowd, and then the daycare center popped up around that time period. And, you know, people played these different sort of social roles, and it started to be something quite different than, you know, what the first couple nights anyway. It was a little frightening, you know. It's hard not to have control over this large thing. And, you know, in the beginning I felt largely responsible for it. You know, because I've been active for a long time. I knew a lot of people involved with, like, those the initial night. You know, I was up on, I was talking to one of the Capitol police that night. And he said, yeah, you know, there were some windows broken. You know, there was a little bit of vandalism. And, you know, I was trying to work them a little bit and just, you know, say, you know, I said, those aren't our people. I don't know who did that. You know, our people are under control. You know, we don't do stuff like that. If you have problems, you know, bring it to me. I'll talk to people, you know. This is before we had the whole marshal system going, you know, where people were. It's a great, you know, it's a good, you know, the marshal system.
Yeah, yeah. But if you want to elaborate about it at this point, that would be good.
I wasn't terribly involved with marshaling, but, you know, the some of the various members of unions would, they'd wear like a blaze color jersey. And then their goal was to negotiate between the crowds and the police officers. Mm. It helps keep the peace. That way, if somebody in the crowd is getting rowdy, somebody who's clearly identified as an ally will, you know, try to get them to calm down, rather than having a police officer do it, which tends to be more antagonistic because there's more authority power issues that happen there. You know, mm-hmm. I had to do some of it. You know, calming people down. It was really. That's not my favorite thing either, you know. No Fox News camera recording people like working themselves up and getting red in the face, angry and screaming, and you just can't have that. You know, you have to be careful around cameras, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
Could you talk a bit more about what you mentioned earlier, the TA war room?
Yeah.
Where it was,
yeah.
And maybe a bit about how it came to be, and then maybe how it, sort of its initial
mm-hmm.
war room, and if it did change over time, how it changed over time.
I think it was 230 Northeast, maybe, was the room number in the Capitol. It's written down someplace, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the exact number. I'm not sure. Eventually, at some point, probably a Democratic ally said, here, you can use this room. Go up to this room, and you can gather in here and use it for, you can plug in your, you can leave your stuff here, you can sleep here, do whatever you need to in this space. So people brought in wireless routers and such, and we made it, you know, because there was internet access, then, you know, people congregated there. And there aren't many outlets in the Capitol. When you need, I mean, like, when I was there, I was working on my laptop constantly, you know, doing the stuff I needed to do. And so you need constant power support source, you know. And so there aren't very few places in the Capitol you could go. I mean, there's no outlets in that building. And so everyone kind of gathered in this room. I was there a little bit. It got weird, though. Just about everyone there, I mean, it got to be this really high, strung, intense sort of place. It was so unpleasant in there because it was so filled with this sort of tension. Maybe not everyone would agree with me, but I've heard many people say that it was way too aggressive in there. But so I eventually moved out into the hallway because there was an outlet in the hallway right outside the room. So I could be, you know, working near there and I could grab the people I wanted, but then I didn't have to actually sit in the room more than I needed to. Let's see, what else about that room? I found it more frustrating than anything. I mean, like I told you before, you know, I've been active for a really long time. I knew everything. And then there were lots of, like, strangers who would kind of just wander into the room. So at some point, somebody or other put somebody at the door, somebody I didn't know at the door, to, like, try to, like, keep people out of the room. You know, so I tried to walk in the room one time to be like, who are you? Why are you coming in here? I said, get out of my way, you know. You don't know who anyone is, you know. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I didn't mean to be an ass about it. I tried to be, like, I belong here, really, trust me. So it got frustrating because then you had, I mean, for me personally, and, you know, there were lots of, you know, sort of young upstarts who thought they knew everything about everything. They wanted to help. And they were given these jobs, but they weren't. They haven't been too active, and you know. Yeah. But tensions were running high anyway, so just part of the normal daily life there. You know, mm-hmm. Little spats and conflicts that you know you just have to hug out or whatever.
Another thing I want to ask, you mentioned the sort of the liaison between the police and the the crowd.
Mm-hmm. Marshals.
The police themselves, a couple of the folks that I've talked to who were part of the 60s and 70s, their sort of general comment was it was interesting to be a part of something where the police appeared to be on our side. This is my general question is just, you know, in your own personal, you mentioned one little anecdote there, but your own personal experience with law enforcement in and around the Capitol.
The police are on our side. The one officer, you know, that first night when I was up all night, I spent a lot of time with one or two Capitol policemen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he recognized me. Weeks later, he recognized me. I bet he'd still remember me. I remember what his face looks like. You know, we made an impression on each other that night, I guess. I think they were definitely on our side. I really empathize for, you know, with the hard job that they had trying to maintain the peace. And I didn't always agree with everything they did, but you know, not like acting violently, right? Like, you know, they looked the other way a lot. They could have been a little more active, but you know, I don't understand the dynamic of their workplace and what. I mean, Chief Tubbs is like in trouble now. Like, isn't Steve Nass going after him for trying to get him fired because he was too permissive or something? So, you know, really, I have nothing but empathy for their situation. I had a few fun conversations. I mean, one time, when was this? This was around April 4th, I think. This is about when when did the senators come back? Was that around that was March 12th?
I think so.
Yeah. There was a huge rally. The Democrats came back. There was the vote. There's nothing we could do.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was then, though I could get the exact date for you if I thought about it a little bit more.
It's March 12th was definitely a Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
So
I could link it to a photograph I have, but we're trying, we're... Yes. No. Darn it. So it was March 9th that we stormed the Capitol, right?
Right.
Then March 10th, there was a vote.
As word spread, the vote was coming. Hundreds of protesters moved in the building before its official 6 p.m. closing.
Right.
That's Wednesday, March 9th.
Yeah. So it was that Thursday that they passed the bill in committee.
Mm-hmm.
And so on that Thursday, that's when the protesters were dragged out from the Senate antechamber, right?
I think so.
And so I stormed in because the Capitol had been locked down for a couple days. And I got in on the 8th for the first time in several days because it was locked on that Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And the preceding Sunday. And so I was in. I slept there. The last night I slept there. And then that next day, I was sitting in the antechamber. And then, you know, nothing seemed to be happening. And so I walked out. Somebody said, you know, we should really, like, survey the Capitol grounds. Like, we've all been sitting in this antechamber, like, all night long and sleeping here. And, like, why couldn't they do this in the assembly room, like right on the other side of the Capitol? And I said, well, that's a really good point, but I think I'm going to go and like walk the perimeter and try to listen to some cops and see what, you know, they have, if anything's going on over on that side, you know, make sure that there's no obvious plan, because nobody was over there and we're a small crew again, you know. And so I walked around and I went over and listened to some police officers. And Then things started getting rowdy, and they started dragging people out. I was back with it over near them when they were dragging people out. I couldn't get in again, but as they were dragging people out, I could only take it for so long. It was really painful to be there for that. So, you know, the crowd didn't know what to do. Lots of people were getting angry. Some people got hurt when they were being dragged out. That wasn't fun. Then you know, the crowd started singing "We Shall Overcome," which made everything just even more, like, you know, horribly painful to endure, you know. So anyway, I was there for as long as I could take it, which was, you know, quite a while. And then I walked over. I thought, I have to get out of this crowd. I need just a break. This is too intense. You know, people screaming. You know, the physical stuff that's going on, the singing. You know, yeah. So I went over to the other side to catch my breath and, you know, clear my head for a few minutes. And there were a bunch of police officers on the other side, and I was listening in to see if I could learn anything. You know, they're talking on their walkie-talkies, and I went up and started talking to one. I said, you know, good day to be working on this side of the Capitol, mm-hmm. huh? And he looked at me, got a big smile on his face, and said, yep. But yeah, they didn't want to talk much, but they were obviously very relieved that weren't having to move bodies that day. But, you know, all that said, depending, the different officers, too, had different roles. Like, when the Capitol Police became less important and the DOA started looking for more state troopers coming in from out of the city, I don't know this, but I'm pretty sure that they were cherry-picked for their political leanings to come and serve in the Capitol. Because there were random people who came from all over the state, and they were mean. You know, they were not friendly. These were the people that were watching the doors, and, like, you know, people who had identification to go in there, like Democratic staffers, and they were just denied. You know, no, you can't come in. You know, people who work in the building couldn't get in. You know, and that was the state troopers who were doing that. And, you know, that's why I think that they were, you know, cherry-picked a bit. So, yeah, that was... They actually confiscated people's ID, because people would have these, like, badges or whatever that they could work in the building, And the office, the troopers would say, oh, let me take a look at that, and they'd grab it, and then they'd walk away with it, and it's just stealing. Then you don't have ID to get in the building. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Then there, what's better, I saw, when they started using the tunnels, too, they had hired a private security firm to guard the entrances of the tunnels. And they were assholes. There were some great, like, underground, like, videos of these private security companies who guarded the tunnel doors, and you know, I forget who it was. I think I met her once or something. And there was a YouTube video she did. Just you know, she went up with a camera and started recording this conversation she had with these guys, and she asked them who they worked for. And they said they were police officers, and she asked if she could see identification, and they said that she had no right to ask for identification. She said, well, that's funny, because police officers have to show identification. And he said, you better get out of here or I'm going to arrest you. And she said, how can you arrest me if you're not a police officer? And he said, this is private property. You have to leave. I'll arrest you. She said, this is the parking garage. I'm parked right over here. Why can't I be in here? And, you know, they kept going back and forth like this. Yeah, so they were them too. So, yeah.
You talk about some of these later Saturday rallies, like the, I think it was the March 12th rally that when the 14 returned.
Mm-hmm.
There was also, and that, I don't know if that was the same day as the tractors that drove around.
That was the Tractorcade.
That was Tractorcade Day. And my question would be, was there a different vibe on the weekend, especially as this sort of went along and more people would come on the weekend than during the week?
Yeah, I think so. I think we always looked forward to the weekends, because then, you know, we knew the crowds would be bigger. I think, you know, all things said and done, the real excitement occurred over the course of like 6 weeks. The first week I was super involved. The second week I caught that nasty flu that went around, and so I was at home a lot that week, and then I was back the third week. But I looked forward to the weekends, because I knew I could catch a break and catch up with my own work a little bit. Because I thought, oh, the rallies are fine. My body does not have to be in this position. I can, you know, prep for teaching, I can grade the stuff I need to grade.
Mm-hmm.
And but I mean, I showed up at the Tractorcade Day and such, but you know, I usually just showed up and hung out for a while and marched a little bit and then went home.
There's at least one more thing I want to ask you today, and then I want to
yeah.
you know, reserve the right to sort of review this, and mm-hmm. and we probably will meet at least one more time to try to
sure.
maybe put a bow on it. And that's just what you said. One of the questions we have specifically for TAs is, first off, specifically, what class were you teaching last spring?
I was actually hired as a lecturer last spring. I was teaching a course on Sami culture.
Okay. So you mentioned, you sort of alluded to this, but
mm-hmm.
how did you budget your time during these, you know, basically the 6 weeks,
mm-hmm.
Trying to balance being an activist, but also being, you know, in this case, a paid lecturer?
Well, it wasn't easy. You know, it was one of the most difficult, you know, couple months of my life trying to, you know, budget my time. I didn't make a lot of progress on my dissertation, that's for sure. But, you know, there's some things that are more important. During the initial, I think we missed three classes. I taught Tuesdays and Thursdays. We missed three classes. And, you know, it wasn't a strike. It was a teach out. So we made up the work. I had them, I believe, for two of the classes, I had I budgeted, in my syllabus, I thought, well, at some point we'll watch a movie. You know, I've kind of figured we'll watch maybe two movies this semester on Sami culture, and then I can, you know, in case I'm falling behind with work and I just can't get my... It was the first time I taught the course. It was all this new content. So I thought, well, I'll just kind of tentatively have those sitting in the bag so I can just pull them out. We'll watch a movie this week, you know, rather than having a lecture. So I did one of those for two of the sessions. I had them watch a movie online. Illegally downloaded, of course. And then the third one, I think I put up a PowerPoint on a Learn at UW site, and then I held some extra office hours or something to make up for the time. They had a paper due or something, so I figured it would be, you know, a good time to have some extra office hours anyway. So.
Did you get any blowback from the students about...
Not a bit. I'm sure they didn't all agree with me, but, you know, I think... I leveled with them, too. I mean, I said... well, for the first one, the first was the Tuesday when there was the Joint Finance Committee hearing. I wrote them an email, like, on that Monday, and I said... We're not going to have class tomorrow. I said that, you know, I'm very, you know, I told them about the joint finance hearing. I said, I think it's my, you know, sort of moral responsibility to be at this hearing to testify because, you know, I think that this is a very important issue for public, for higher education. And it's, you know, it's more important that I'm there, you know, on this day, to give my 3 minutes than be in class. I said we'd make it up, and I didn't try to say they should agree with me or not agree with me, but I just told them the truth that I thought I should be there. Then we called the teach outs too. And, you know, there's some weird bureaucratic language that came from the university, which you might sort of remember. We're trying to read between the lines, like, the TAA, like, core of activists at that time, and what are they really saying? Are they saying, because they issued policy statements that were like, you shouldn't be holding your classes off campus, but, you know, of course you have flexibility to hold class whenever you'd like to have class and do your work schedule on you can schedule your classes anytime you'd like to schedule your classes. These are only recommended time slots or something. Basically, they're saying you have a lot of flexibility in how you teach. And, you know, if the university was really didn't want us there, they would have been issuing statements like, anyone who cancels class is going to be fired, you know, which is what, you know, that would be like the tack that union busting universities take. But, I mean, they wanted to, I mean, this university is incredibly union-friendly, but, I mean, they're not, they knew what was in store for the UW system and the budget anyway. So I think there were lots of people who were willing to let the university fight for itself and kind of look the other way. So that's the message we got anyway from reading between the lines. And then, you know, again, the second time I said, well, there's a teach-out, TAA called a teach-out. I said, I don't remember the exact text of my email, but my message was, I basically said, I don't cross picket lines. I do with it. I, you know, stand in solidarity with, you know, teaching assistants and, you know, and undergrads who have called for, you know, no classes to be taught on this day, and that's what I'm gonna honor. And, you know, I said, you know, thanked him for indulging me and, you know, No one complained. And many students thanked me. Many students thanked me.
Since we've been talking about this for an hour or so now, I think this is my last thing for today. And just because, we've been talking about it, so hopefully it's on your mind. And this is one of these really open-ended questions, so it could go anywhere or nowhere. What was or was there for you a high point? And then conversely, was there a low point?
In the whole protest?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of my favorite things, one of my favorite things was, it was probably that first Thursday and the first week, you know, when this sort of thing, this was taking a life of its own, and there was this realization that, you know, the vibe was so much that you know, you can turn up, 30,000 people or 50,000 people or whatever we were on those days, and it wasn't good enough to even make it, a ripple in the political process. You know, it was such a feeling that, of being, isolated from and disenfranchised from, like, what politics are in this country. And it was a hard thing to swallow. We could have turned out a million people, and they still didn't give a shit, because they were going to do whatever the hell they were going to do. And so there was a sort of awakening realization to this. But, at the same time, like, we started really taking control of the Capitol at that time. And there was this one moment in particular, periodically, because I was working in the hallway for like a week, periodically I would go out and look at the crowds and just kind of think, wow, look at this. This is amazing. I mean, there were some real moments there, So I was out there, and then I heard a roar in the crowd. And I looked down, I was trying to figure, why are they roaring now? And I looked down, and somebody had smuggled in all these helium balloons. And, this is the first day I think anyone brought any helium balloons in, because, they're not allowed. And so they brought in a bunch of helium balloons, and they had tied onto it a sign with the solidarity fist. And they let them go, and this beautiful sign was floating up to the top of the Capitol dome. It was just one of those moments that bring me chills. I mean, it was sort of the, we took the building, and it was like a hoisting of a flag. It was a sign of victory, of sorts anyway. Because you feel like the whole, the state house being a house of the people is just a sham, so we hoisted our own flag, and it felt really good. So that was one of my high points anyway. There are several instances like that. Another would be coming out of when the occupation ended, because there was a standoff from that Sunday when they did the lockdown until like maybe Wednesday or Thursday, when people just kind of gradually trickled out because like they wanted to shower and eat. And so then we coordinated an exit, because we didn't want the numbers just to get smaller and smaller and smaller. So the last 30 people were in there, and so a couple hundred people showed up to welcome them when they came out and make it feel like a victory. This is probably March 3rd-ish, the last day of the occupation, 3rd, 4th. And everyone marched out one by one as heroes. I was on the outside, of course. I wasn't inside. They marched out as heroes. They negotiated this exit for a long time. And, and they were playing music and chanting and singing and dancing, because there are lots of the drum circles. You have a corps that still gets in trouble regularly down there. And then everyone went over to Brokaw afterwards, and they had their first hot meal for, that wasn't pizza for ages. So everyone went there, and there was an Irish band playing. And then some of my friends from the TAA, like Rob Henn and Mike Quito, he's a former co-president going back a decade or more. And they went down to the band and asked the band to start playing Union songs. So then the band started playing Union songs, and they were singing, and people were dancing and singing along. It was just one of these great organic moments, where everything just sort of came together. It just felt really good. As far as low points go, you know, I think dejection is just part of the daily process, you know. You know, you feel good for a while, and then you think, oh, God, we can't win, you know. And, you know, it's something you struggle with, you know. Maybe daily, you know, for those 6 weeks. I struggle with it, you know. I struggled with it when, you know, Kloppenberg lost. I struggled with it when the recalls only picked up 2 seats. You know, you keep looking for silver linings and things, but, you know, ultimately, you know, there's a lot of disappointment that goes along, you know, with trying to launch a historic sort of fight, you know. So, I mean, like, literally, you can go, like, you know, for a while, everyone just has to check out for a while and remember that your life is tied to other things than, like, you know, winning this sort of political fight. Otherwise, you go a little bit nuts, I think. So.
All right, I think that I hate to end on a low point.
But, oh, that's all right.
I think it's probably a good stopping point for today. Thank you very much, Tim. I appreciate it.